It is my great pleasure this evening on behalf of the European Institute and the London School of Economics to welcome today our first speaker for the new Lent term 2017. We are honored to be joined today by Helle Thorning-Schmidt, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Save the Children's Fund. As I'm sure you are aware, Helle Thorning-Schmidt has a very distinguished record already. She was, of course, Prime Minister of Denmark from 2011 to 2015, acting as leader of the Social Democratic Party in a coalition government. And before that, she served as a member of the European Parliament from 1999 to 2004. We will today be benefiting from her insights in a new area of priority interest for Save the Children, and I know for many of us here at the London School of Economics, which is, of course, the great problem of protecting children in war and conflict.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Lovely, warm welcome. I'm delighted to be here today. It is it's a privilege to have been asked to speak here. I've never been here before. And thank you very much to Jenny for the kind introduction. I promise you I won't speak the whole time. There will be time for your analysis, your questions. So I promise you I will leave time for that. But it is true that I'll speak about children in war and conflict. This is something that is very close to my heart. This is something that Save the Children will have as a new focus area, not new, but renewed focus area. And I hope that you will think that it is interesting. I certainly do. Bergen-Belsen, 1945. A 15-year-old girl dies in concentration camp less than 2 months before its liberation, leaving behind a diary of a life in hiding in the back room of a townhouse in Amsterdam. Her name, of course, was Anne Frank. Vietnam, 1972, a naked, burned young girl, 9 years old, runs screaming down the road, chased by a cloud of napalm. Her name is Pan Ti Kim Phuc. Soweto, 1976, in the arms of a fellow student, a dying 13-year-old boy is carried away from the student protest in which he has been shot by the police in the apartheid South Africa. His name was Hector Peterson. Turkey, 2015, the lifeless body of a 3-year-old boy lies at the Mediterranean water's edge. His name was Alan Kudi. Aleppo, 2016, a dazed, bloodied 5-year-old boy sits in the back of an ambulance after surviving an airstrike from his own government. His name is Omran Dagnish. These are just 5 of the many children who have become icons of the horror of conflict and war. And their suffering provokes the deepest shock and outrage. It goes to our essential humanity, and we all remember, of course, what it was like to be a child at their age, how innocent we were, the potential we had and was ready to be realized, and of course also you remember as a child how vulnerable we were. So reliant on those people around you. And that is why the suffering of children in conflict and wars goes against every moral precept of law and principle, and it makes what I would call a brutal mockery of that eternal idea that through the eyes of a child you will see the world as it should be. As the great child rights champion, Graca Machel, has said, children must be zones of peace. The achievement of that goal, so far away, is what I would like to talk to you about tonight. It is an issue that fills us with horror, but I also want you to leave this room tonight f- filled with a little bit of hope and a question to all of us about what can we do. I've been in public service for 25 years, and as leader of my party, as member of the European Parliament, as Prime Minister, and now as CEO of Save the Children International, I've always believed that if you can improve the lives and futures of children, then you can actually transform the world to the better. Children, we know, will one day they make the decisions that shape our world, in their families, in their communities, in their workplaces, in government, and across the international community. And the perspectives, the experiences, the beliefs, the knowledge, the skills, the attitudes that will determine how they carry out those tasks almost always have their roots in the childhood. And so, just as in the words of the Declaration on the Rights of the Child, mankind owes the child the best it has to offer. And it is also a truth that the fate of the world is truly determined by the lives of our children. And these truths, they mean that it is both a moral and, I would add, a strategic imperative for the international community to protect the world's children, our children, from the horrors of armed conflict. And yet, 15 million children are directly caught up in violent conflict. 10 million children have fled conflict, and 1 billion children live in countries affected by armed conflict. Over a third of the world's child death happens in countries that are affected by conflict or that have sizable refugee populations. I invite everyone to read the latest report of the UN Secretary General on children in armed conflict. It's a horror story. And what I keep wondering about is this. Why are we not more outraged? Why are we seeing this and not being more outraged? How can it be that girls as young as 5 are being raped, that young boys are still forced to become child soldiers, that children are being attacked in supposedly safe places such as schools and hospitals? These events happen every day around the world. And if violence against children is like disease in the way it spreads through population, it reaches epidemic proportions in zones of war. In 2005, the UN Security Council codified 6 violations against children. Those 6 are 1, the recruitment and use of children as soldiers; 2, the killing and maiming of children; 3, sexual violence against children; 4, attacks against schools and hospitals; 5, the abduction of children; and 6, the denial of humanitarian access. And, of course, these all too common violations are horrific enough in themselves, but yet, of course, they exist on top of the incredibly difficult circumstances that children affected by armed conflicts are living under. Destroyed communities, increased hunger and disease, homelessness, the absence of schooling, and the breakdown of every part of society as we who have not lived through the war imagine it. And the multitude and the depth of these impacts all contribute to the unrelenting fear and stress that these children live in. And of the children that do survive, many suffer from physical injuries. And long after those physical scars may have healed, the psychological effects of exposure to conflicts and violence continue to destroy lives. Children often, of course, struggle from post-traumatic stress, reflected in disturbed behavior, emotional, and, of course, sleep problems. And alongside these problems, the physical, the psychological problems, war will often have an impact on children's education. Conflict very often means lack of schooling. And that means, of course, that even though children escape the conflict and continue living and continue their lives when the conflict ends, they are enormously disadvantaged. And as such, too often, violence leads to more violence, and conflict leads to more conflict. We have to remember about these children that they are, of course, are the members of society of tomorrow. They are the leaders of tomorrow. And it is our responsibility to do everything that we can to ensure that the world's children will be able to play their unique role in that is not defined by violence and suffering inflicted on them, but by their potential and by their character. I know this is a very big challenge. And I want to try to outline where the challenge is in actually changing this and what the challenge is for children. Why are children special? Well, the thing is with children, often in armed conflict, they have no one to represent them. Often they don't have a government or no powerful political constituency to take up their cause. And children are not just vulnerable because they are small. They are vulnerable because they don't have a voice. And particularly when they don't have a government to be their voice, that makes them very vulnerable. But it also means that that lack of voice and agency gives us, the international community, an increased responsibility. Second, of course, and I know many of you will be thinking of this, is the challenge of delivery. Even when we know what the solutions are or what the solutions should be, the context on the ground can make implementation very, very hard or even impossible. Just look at the situation in Aleppo here in 16. That was a devastating example of realities of working in war zones. And perhaps above all, dealing with conflict is very complex, and the international community can often show a lack of political courage and foresight. And children are shamefully actually not given the priority that they require, be it in investment, focus, and strategic agreement. Those challenges call on us, I believe, to create a new global movement that is powerful enough to offer the children in armed conflict survival, protection, and hope. We need a new compact, a new deal for these children. Is this ambitious? It certainly is. But if ever our resolve wavers, we can take heart from one fact: we have done this before. In 1919, in the shadows of the World War I, Europe was suffering a severe humanitarian crisis. 4 or 5 million children were starving in Central and Eastern Europe. And the rates of infant and child mortality were at record highs. That same year, a British woman called Eglantine Jebb proclaimed, "All wars are waged against children." And she began handing out leaflets on Trafalgar Square with pictures of Europe's starving children to encourage action to lift the Allied blockade and on defeated countries. She faced enormous resistance. There were many back then that believed that Britain should help its own children rather than the enemy's children. But with a broad coalition of support, that including actually one of LSE's founders, George Bernard Shaw, she set up the first children's charity that had an international focus. That charity was Save the Children. And in the 20s, the 1920s, it went on to feed and educate thousands of Russian refugees in Turkey, and the 20,000 children left orphaned in the wake of the civil war in Finland. And as this happened, Eglantine's vision grew. It grew beyond emergency relief to making children's rights an essential part of the world order. Just imagine how that must have sounded in the 1920s Europe. But that was her thought, and what she said was this: every generation of children offers mankind anew the possibility of rebuilding his ruin of a world. And you can't say that Save the Children has changed much since then. We still believe that is the case. Eglantine actually had a huge success. She drafted the first ever Declaration of Children's Rights. This was adopted by the League of Nations in 1924, and 65 years later, it inspires the most wide-ranging expression of the principle that all children, and not just our children, have the same rights. The 1989 UN Convention of the Rights of the Child. And this sits now as part of a global 20th century's rights-based agenda that stretches from the UN Charter of and Universal Declaration of Human Rights to the European Human Rights Convention and the International Refugee Regime. And together, these frameworks delivered immense progress for human beings and promised even more. And highly relevant to the topic that we are discussing today, they include specific protections for children in armed conflict. These protections have luckily been extended over time, as this unique vulnerability of children has been recognized as part of international humanitarian law. The Geneva Convention that was signed right after the Second World War was actually a watershed moment for recognizing that human rights always apply. And now we have a situation where even war have rules. And we have an international criminal court to enforce them, which just last year actually adopted a policy to facilitate the prosecutions of crimes against children. In 1996, Graça Machel delivered what I would call a groundbreaking report for the UN on the impact of armed conflict on children. And that led to the creation of a UN Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict to monitor and report violations. That's another report you should read. And we have recently seen the power of that reporting system, the power of actually having an impartial and robust reporting. We saw that, and I was a little bit involved in that discussion in September in the UN General Assembly, when Saudi Arabia reacted extraordinarily strongly to being cited by the Secretary General for killing children in Yemen. They didn't like that. And with this, with Graça Machel's report, we have actually seen over the years a number of advancing in the systems we have for monitoring and reporting and accountability. And in particular, sexual violence against children and attacks on schools and hospitals, that is areas that we have been putting attention to. So despite the recent rise in violations of human laws in conflict, I still think there is still real scope to make real progress for children through the work we are doing. And if we add to that the development work that we are doing, we can see real progress. Let me give you an example where it actually really makes sense to have the rights-based agenda combined with development work. Take Afghanistan as an example. Afghanistan is one of the poorest countries of the world. It has been beset by war for 4 decades. It has nonetheless actually reduced child death by almost 1/3 in the last 15 years. Why is this? This is down to improving some of the basics in that country, such as tripling the number of birth attendants to children. Skilled attendants that can be with the mother when she has her baby. It is down to doubling of the coverage of life-saving vaccines. This is something that international donors, including my own country when I was Prime Minister, supported, which are working supported by organisations like Save the Children, can actually achieve. And I think that is one of the good stories we have to take with us. So, nearly a century after Save the Children was founded, the advance of the basic rights for children in every part of global society, combined with improved humanitarian and development delivery, and of course enormous economic growth across the piece, all those things put together have together led to a situation where children have never been healthier, wealthier, better educated, and safer than they are today. And I say that because we also need to take comfort from the changes that have been made by man. Wars are the work of man. Peace can be the work of man as well. And this is work that has been done by men and women to change the world to a better place. And just remember this, there has been important gains. But conflict is still widespread. And what are we seeing today? Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, South Sudan, Northern Nigeria. And in each of these places, we are seeing a new and worrying incarnations of long perpetrated violence of children's rights. Children are continuously used as soldiers and weapons of war. In South Sudan, we have 17,000 children that have been recruited into armed groups. In Nigeria, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, we see Boko Haram, ISIS, and the Taliban force children to strap their vest on and blow themselves up. And the vital infrastructure that actually supports children is deliberately being attacked. In Yemen, three health facilities were repeatedly hit in 23 incidents throughout 15. In Syria, of the 60 schools that Save the Children supported in Idlib and Aleppo in 16, 44 were damaged by bombing. And children are now the deliberate target of conflict. In northeast Nigeria, hundreds of children have been abducted in a brutal insurgency that has now driven more than 2 million people from their homes. Perhaps the greatest suffering for children in conflict is forced displacement. Estimates are telling us that over 65 million people around the world have been forced away from their homes. And over 1 million of these people have made their way to Europe. And tonight, as it is hosted by the European Institute, I would like to talk a little bit about that specifically. We have seen over the last few years that the influx of refugees is pushing Europe's political cooperation to its absolute limits. And we are also seeing that Europe's commitment to the rights-based ethos on which Europe and European Union was built has actually weakened. And that's worrying. We are seeing children that are now dying on the way to Europe. And if they arrive safely in Europe, they are often detained or held in detention-like conditions. And I've met those children. I've spoken to them. And it is very clear that immigration detention is never in a child's best interest. And also, of course, it's a clear contravention of the Convention of the Rights of the Child. And as we sit here this evening, there are still hundreds of children that are stuck in Greece, denied the opportunity to be reunited with their families, and thousands of children are spending another winter in flimsy shelter without access to adequate education or healthcare. I believe, and have believed for many years, that European member states should have stepped up. And this is not what we would have expected from member states or the European Union. And as it happened in 1919, Save the Children have actually had to scale up our work in Europe. We operate a search and rescue vessel in the Mediterranean. We provide the basics of food, shelter, and protection to children in Greece and in the Balkans. We support protection and integration for child refugees in Germany and Sweden. And as in 1919, when Eglantine Jebb raised funds to support German and Austrian children, there is a growing notion that these children are not our children and not our responsibility. I believe that's a very dangerous reaction, not just for the future of those children, that goes without saying, but actually for the future of Europe and European integration itself. Why is that? I see three simple reasons. The first is that by neglecting our obligations to the vulnerable, European countries actually risk of irreparably damaging or weakening the international frameworks, norms, and principles that it has taken decades to build up. And if we do that, it's not only a European question. No, it is a fact that if Europe does not adhere to the agreed norms and standards, why should others? The second reason is that we know that these children, one way or the other, will be part of Europe's future, whether it is in the countries they were born or in new homes in Europe. And what do we think their future attitude towards European society will be if their experience tells them that they don't matter? They don't matter to European governments, and they don't matter to European publics. As we have seen all too vividly in the last 2 years, the attitudes and beliefs of victims of war, refugees, actually matter. And our rights-built ethos, built on compassion, is not only a moral imperative then, no, it's actually also a tactical and a strategic one. And the third thing is, why should we be doing this? Because it is simply the right thing to do. If you are a parent, you will tell your children that the value of beliefs is not just in holding them. No, it is practicing them, especially when it's hard. And for 7 decades since the Second World War, Europe's ability to promote a rights-based agenda abroad has very much hinged on the standards we in Europe have set at home. And to stop now will be to weaken its future. This dilemma in Europe is just one example of how the future is inextricably linked to the lives of the children in the present. And I'm worried that our resolve and commitment to children's rights seems to be weakening. Across the world, the suffering of children in armed conflict challenges the progress that we have made since the Second World War. And as Graça Machel has said, it is unforgivable that children are assaulted, violated, murdered, and yet the world's conscience is not revolted, nor our sense of dignity challenged. This represents a fundamental crisis of our civilization. I agree with that, but I also think it represents a fundamental crisis of our future. And so, I'm here with you tonight. Many of you are students, and you are members of one of the greatest institutions of thinking, ideas, and innovation in the world, founded for the betterment of society. And in fact, the reason I like speaking with students is that I always feel that you embody the words of George Bernard Shaw when he said, some see things as they are and say, why? I dream of things that never were and say, why not? That is the question we need to raise. And that is the scale of the ambition the world needs now for its children, especially children in armed conflict. And we need this nearly a century after one British woman decided to act. This is now where we must create a new code, a new impact, a new global movement that is powerful enough to offer the children in armed conflict survival, protection, and hope. We must guarantee that the rights that we have created for all children, that we finally live up to its promises we have made to them of a better future and a more peaceful tomorrow. This cause is great, and it can be a bit daunting. I agree with you if you're thinking that. The task is urgent. But I also feel that because it has been done before, it is possible. And in Save the Children, as you can hear, we are approaching our centenary. That will be in 2019. That is actually what we will recommit ourselves to do, from campaigning and convening to delivery on the ground. And I have a feeling that even though a lot of things are disappointing in the world right now, we can discuss them after, but even though many things are disappointing, I think there are actually a number of opportunities that we can use right now to make a new rules for children a reality. What are those? Well, first in 2015, the world agreed the UN Sustainable Development Goals. That's a global agenda that has ending all forms of violence against children as one of its foundation, its goal 16. And every part of society can actually contribute to that realization. We also right now have a new Secretary General of the UN. This is Antonio Guterres. He's a great guy, and he's also the former UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and he knows firsthand how much war destroys children's futures. And he has already declared that 2017 is a year of peace, and of course we must support him and as strongly as possible in any progress that he can make. The third reason is, and this might sound a bit counterintuitive, the third reason is that we have a European Union that needs renewal. And maybe there's no better time when Europe is in turmoil, no better time for Europe to actually find a course to reassert itself. To reassert itself as a preeminent child rights champion. As we have been before, we need to be that again. And we need to do that through a focus on the protection of children in armed conflict, both within our borders and in those countries that are shouldering most of the burden. When we discussed Brexit, we saw that the EU's vital role as a peacekeeper and peacemaker has largely been forgotten. And yet, that to be a peacemaker is actually the best argument for a continental political union that influenced the rest of the world. And it would be a shame that at the same time where we could show what Europe could do for peacekeeping and protecting children, if we stepped away from children's rights. So, where does this start? It starts with us hoping that it can happen, us seeing the opportunities that are, despite everything else, there, and what do we have to do? Well, let's work that out together. Some of the elements that I'm thinking of are the following. First of all, the rights-based international order must begin with stronger accountability for war crimes committed against children. You all know that this is a job for the International Criminal Court, and this is one of the best, actually the Criminal Court is one of the best, I hate to say it, but weapons we have in the global fight to end impunity. And of course this didn't get easier in 2016 when Russia withdrew from the Criminal Court and a number of African countries, but that cannot make us disdain, lose hope. We need to keep trying. And one of the things that we actually can prioritize here and now is to end immunity for the sexual exploitation and abuse by UN peacekeeping personnel against children. I'll let that stand for a second. You heard right. Sexual exploitation and abuse of children by UN peacekeepers. We know that this kind of exploitation and abuse increased in 2015, and we know that reports have increased every year since 2013. We also know that sexual exploitation and abuse of children is actually increasing, and it is not right. It is simply not right that peacekeepers who rape, demand sexual favors in exchange for food, are never prosecuted. The new Secretary-General has already condemned the crimes being committed under the UN flag, and all of us should work with him to find a solution that will end this horrific practice. What can we do? Again, we need to think outside the box. If countries that are providing peacekeeping forces can't or won't hold perpetrators to account, we need a different solution. And one idea could be, in the absence of a functional judicial system, that we create special courts designed to hold peacekeepers to account. And in addition to identifying good ideas, we should also make use of the UN systems that we already have in place. We have a UN-led monitoring and reporting mechanism on grave violations against children in conflict. This is a mechanism that is run by UNICEF and its partners, and what it does is that it collects information on crimes committed against children to then share with the UN Security Council. But it's chronically underfunded, and what we need is to increase funding in order to improve the quality of data and also the frequency of reporting, the coverage of reporting, and of course the much needed assistance for the victims of violence who are brave enough to come out and tell their stories. We know that more than half of those affected by war are children. Half. But we also know that less than 5% of humanitarian funding is spent protecting or educating these children. This has to change. We need you. I believe that if we are going to put new rules that will go against and there will mean more protection of children in war and conflict, I think everyone has a role to play. And if you want to change the world, there is no better course, greater course, than the protection of children in armed conflict. I also think we have to realize that inaction has some deep consequences. And because what we know is that what happens to a child means that violence and conflict can be part of a vicious generational circle. And to break it, we simply have to transform the experiences, perspectives, and prospects of those who are children today. It is possible, and that's my main message today. I know it is a very black picture that I paint of the situation for children, war, and conflict, but I still believe that it is possible to create a better world. And what do I take hope from? I take hope from our history. I take hope from the fact that we actually have made a world that is a better place for children. But I also take hope from all the children I meet. I have traveled a lot since I joined Save the Children, and I have met some incredible children. They simply inspire us with their enormous resilience and also their hope for the future. I have met so many children that were in the most difficult circumstances, but in their eyes, there are still hope. And every time I come away from those children, I ask myself, when does that hope shut down? When is that light of hope turned off in their eyes? And what can I do, what can we do to keep it there and to help it grow? I think these children should be mine and our urgent inspiration. The conditions they live in and the threats they face should drive us to work with more urgency. And their dreams and their hopes should inspire us to create a better life and world for them. And if we succeed, we will also be part of creating a better world for ourselves, a better world for the future. And I hope that some of you, after tonight, will ask yourself, what can I do? What can I contribute? How will I practice my beliefs? Because in the words of one child, written in her diary as war raged across Europe, how wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. Thank you very much.
Well, those were some fascinating and wide-ranging introductory remarks on the problems and possibilities for helping children in war and in conflict. And I say introductory remarks because I know that Hella is particularly interested in hearing from the audience and in having your questions and your comments. I should point out to all of you here that we are running a hashtag for the event. The hashtag is LSE. Children, and if you did want to contribute in that way, then obviously you're encouraged to do so as well. One of the things that really struck me as I was listening to you, I know one of my own major interests in the activity of Save the Children actually is the great impetus and originality you've had in your foundation and going forward in pushing towards political will.
Yeah.
And the story of Eglantine handing out those photographs in Trafalgar Square. As I was listening to you, recalled the videos of 2014 and 2016, the one-minute videos. If the audience hasn't seen it, do take a look at them. They're on YouTube, which showcase a year in the life of a British child who is presented, of course, going into war and conflict situation and becoming a refugee. And again, I think we can see so much continuity between the beginning and today. We will open the floor for your comments and your contributions. I think we have two roving mics on either side. We'll take a series of questions together, maybe three or four, and then we'll come back to Hella for some comments, and we'll go back and forward in that way. If I have as our first question, lady right here, yes.
And hi, thanks so much for that.
Introduce yourself as well, very briefly.
Yes, my name is Evelyn. I'm a PhD student here at the LSE, and I actually work on international activism on child recruitment in particular, so I'm very interested to hear what you're saying. And I have two questions, one maybe more theoretical, the other more practical. So on the first one, you asked in the beginning of your talk, why do we still see this? Why do we still see so much violence against children when clearly we seem to all agree that this is a horrible practice and no one should be doing this? So I wonder how different definitions of childhood play into this and how it also maybe varies from what we in the Western setting might believe the role of a child to be to what maybe other contexts. So I work on Myanmar and Sierra Leone, for example, and maybe in other settings the role of a child is a lot more about resilience, like you said in the end, about responsibility, and this plays into child labor, for example, and partly also in child recruitment. So I wonder how you address that in your work, how you take that into consideration. And the second one, just quickly, you talked a lot about the UN mechanism, monitoring, reporting, etc. This is all aimed at governments and at states, and most of the I know there are non-state actors listed on the naming and shaming list, for example, but how do you address that it's mostly non-state actors? We think of ISIS and child recruitment, all of this. Like, how do you make sure these actors are held accountable when they're not part of the international community as we know it? Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, right in the front, please. The mic's coming down.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. I'm a master's student here at LSC. You mentioned the Convention on the Rights of the Child. In 2016, the Danish government proposed a family reunification bill, which was criticized for being in violation of that convention. So mine is a two-part question. First, can you describe the barriers you faced in implementing refugee child protection rights while you were in government? And second, can you speak about how your position as CEO of Save the Children might allow you to work against such policies, especially in your home country? Thank you.
Thank you. And right over down here at the front, please.
Hello, my name is Sabine, which is German, McNeil, which is not, and I'm here because I've gone to Brussels to ask the petitions committee to help us in the UK to stop forced adoptions, because there are 1,000 children a month that are being taken away from their biological parents. Mm. After we petitioned the UK Parliament, we went to Brussels, and it seems as if Save the Children is our only hope for fighting the money problem, and therefore I find it most interesting that your talk is happening here of all places, the war and peace problem, and the children, i.e. the crisis of the future. And the fact that you mentioned the possibility even of a government that does not represent the voice of children, that is what is actually happening. When I made the presentation of the petition, there was a Romanian MEP who said, "What? Are we in South America?" I loved how you addressed the whole problem areas. At the same time, I need to breathe very deeply to get some hope. And I only see every human being, conscious being, has to become member of Save the Children International. What else can we do?
Well, you'd like to come back on those, Hannah?
Yeah, thanks a lot. On the last question, I'm not so aware of what has happened to the forced adopted children. I'd like to hear more about it. Maybe we can talk about it after. But what we do know, that when you have refugee children, they are always very, very vulnerable. And of course, the children that are traveling alone are the most vulnerable of all. We can't get the figures, but we have been told that the figures on trafficking of these children, slavery, early child marriage, that has gone up enormously, the number of early child marriage, that is because these children are so vulnerable. So that is what it causes. Conflict causes children to flee, and then they become even more vulnerable. And when I talk about that children don't have a government to represent them, in Syria, it was their own government bombing them. And that means that these children are extra vulnerable. Normally, a child or a person has a government to represent them. When they don't, that is where the international community has to really step up and represent people, and particularly children, because they're double vulnerable. So that is what I'm talking about in that context. In terms of the Danish legislation, I was in politics back then, but I don't know if they were in violation of conventions. No one has complained, as far as I know. So we don't know if there were violations of children's rights. But what I do know is that Save the Children Denmark spoke up against these rules. They were adopted anyway, but they spoke up against these rules. In terms of child recruitment, I don't quite know, Evelyn, maybe you could expand. I don't know if we had time for that. But of course, there are cultural differences. You say, what is a child? Is it someone? Yeah, what does childhood mean? Is it someone who's 15 or 18? And should we accept cultural differences in this? There's no doubt that 15 and 18 are two different ages for a child. But 6 is not. 10 years old is not. We have seen children, as I was telling you about here, who are victims of the most horrendous atrocities in those ages. So I accept there is a difference between 15 and 18, but we also have many, many children underneath the age of 15 who are recruited as child soldiers. And I actually think, personally, that we shouldn't distinguish too much. A child is a child, and we have international norms and rights based on the fact that a child is someone who's under 18. And I believe that is a very powerful message, because it also underlines that whoever you are, wherever you live, you have those rights based on the fact that you are a child. So that is how I see it, and I accept there can be cultural differences and debates about this, but in terms of these issues that we are discussing here today, it is very important to remember that, because that is the guide to all of us to when we say, when is special protection required? I've met children in Italy that came in there alone. We protect them, we help them, and they are children when they are under 18. And I think they should be children when they are under 18, because they are very vulnerable in that age to all these things we're discussing here. So I believe we should protect them and understand that they are still children.
We open now to some more questions. Yes, gentleman, green shirt over on this side. This great at the back. Green shirt, I think it was up. Yes, there we go.
Hi, my name's Ashley. I work in communications, which might explain my question. You bring, obviously, to your role a tremendous amount of political experience, and we're living undeniably in a crisis in terms of media and making sure that there is political will to do things. You detailed in your speech a lot of the inaction that emerges from state actors. But I think there is also another element in terms of Western countries. Your own country passed quite a tragic jewellery law. And here in the UK, there seems to be a lot of furor in the Daily Mail and other publications celebrating when they get a victory against international aid, or whether they create this crisis over the size of children's teeth and how that indicates their age. So my question to you is, how do you think your experience can help build political will to make a difference?
Yes, right down here. Lady, right at the side, thank you. Yeah, lady at the back, and then we take the gentleman in the front after that.
Thanks, madam, for your lecture. I have two questions. First question is, what kind of ethics does your organization apply to corporate donors? If a company does not respect children's rights or have an child labor issues, does your organization consider those factors? And my second question is a bit unrelated to today's topic, but from your previous experience as a female politician, do you think that you were faced with, you know, lots of discriminations or prejudice? And if so, what kind of biggest obstacles to women's political participation?
My name is Aaron Du. I am a master's student here at the LSE, Master's in Development Studies from Nigeria. I really love the fact that you did mention the Boko Haram insurgents in my home country. My question is in two parts. One is in regard to what has the Save the Children done in order to assess the current situation of, you know, children in the IDP camps in Maiduguri, in some part of northern part of Nigeria. And my second question...
Can you just repeat that? I didn't quite catch it.
What has the Save the Children done in order to assess the living situation of children in IDP camps in Nigeria,
yeah,
because they are vulnerable to the Boko Haram insurgents? And my second question, if, you know, at the beginning of your remarks, you mentioned that children are the hope of tomorrow. We have seen countries changing their immigration rules. Some wants to build war. I don't want to call him. But what can, you know, using your good office, how can we build a strong coalition, just like everyone rallied around the SDGs, to make sure that children have access to education? Because if they don't have access to education, there will be lost children in decades,
yeah,
to come.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. First of all, I realize that I didn't answer the question from before, which was actually very important. The question is very simple. Well, most of these organizations committing crimes against children in war and conflict, they are not state actors. they're everyone else than state actors. And that's a very, very good point. That's why this is so hard. I think if it was only states, then the task would be easier. But I will say this, that many non-state actors, they have some kind of protection or support or some connection to a government somewhere. Maybe not their own government, but a government somewhere. And I believe we still have to have a strong, have some faith in the international system and the multilateral cooperation, where we can actually speak to those governments that might protect or have connections or do something. And that is something that we have been able to use in other circumstances, and that should be the path of hope in this instance. But it's very, very difficult, but there should still be something that can that could connect us to those groups. So that's what's from before. The other thing was about different governments, and I think I've been participating in this conversation about refugees and rights for many, many years. And I've seen after the European crisis, I would call the European refugee crisis, that there's a big tendency to really go into some governments and demand more of them. And I think that is very helpful. But I also think we have to be careful on picking on the right ones. I've heard Denmark a lot of the times, maybe that's because I'm Danish, but I've heard that. But just remind, let's just remind ourselves, when I was Prime Minister, for example, I tightened certain rules as well, but Denmark was one of the countries just after Sweden that took most Syrian refugees. So you can't really turn to Denmark and say, why should you not be doing more? Denmark is one of the countries in the world that still gives more than 0.7% in development assistance. When I was Prime Minister, it was 0.83%. So there is a strong tendency when we talk about Europe to find some countries and say they should do more, and they probably should. But let's talk about why have not all European countries come together to actually work together to solve this issue. And that is what I was trying to say. I don't think it's useful to pick on the European Union as an organization. I don't think it's useful to try to pick on some countries. I think it's useful to ask some of the countries that are doing absolutely nothing on this and have not taken their fair share of refugees, why they are not doing something, and demand of the European member states that they try to find a solution to this. And that was what I was trying to say. There's a big tendency also to pick on the UK government. I'm not here to defend the UK government. That's not what I do. But I think UK has also done some in this refugee crisis, not as much as Denmark, relatively. But but still, I think that is a discussion that we need to have with each other. Demand some more of the countries that are doing absolutely nothing and are saying we can't have any refugees here. Why is it that the Eastern European countries cannot have any refugees at all in their midst? I just don't get it. So that was one thing I want to say, but I wanted to come back to that, because there is a tendency everywhere to see those pictures of Ayan on that beach, or that little boy we saw in that ambulance, and be shocked and horrified when we see those pictures, but then not do anything. And that is when we all have to demand more of our politicians. Politicians will do what the public wants eventually, so we have to demand more and say, we can help. By working together, we can help these children. And I really believe that we can, if we work together. So I think we should not lose our compassion. We should not lose the fact that we are seeing these things and realizing that this is just not right. We can do better than that. I found myself in a hopeless situation with a lot of other people trying to advocate for something to happen in Syria, a ceasefire, something to happen in Aleppo to get the children out or to get the help in. None of those things were possible. But we should keep pushing politicians to do just that. In terms of corporate donors, this is something I could talk about for a very long time. You ask, are Save the Children working with corporate donors? Yes, we certainly are. On Sunday, I will be off to the World Economic Forum in Davos. I'm co-chairing the event. And this year is about leadership. And one of the theories of change that I have in my head and that we have in Save the Children is basically that we can't just rely on states, on governments, to change things for children. We can't just rely on the UN to do the same, or the EU. Everyone has to pull in the same direction. And that is why in Save the Children, we are very, very good at organizing, working with corporate, doing corporate partnership. It's not just that they write a check and then we start working. No, it is strong, long partnerships where they actually help us deliver on the ground. If some of you ever come to the Satari camp in Jordan, you would be a little bit surprised, I think, to find that there's a big sign out there for Bulgari. I don't know if all of you know what Bulgari is, but it's a luxury brand, an Italian luxury brand. But they have actually committed to a five-year partnership with Save the Children where we help education in that camp. That's quite good. And we do that a lot. We are very, very good at it. I think it's also for them, they are very powerful actors in the world for them to actually work and do more for children with partners that they trust. I think I'll stop here. I'm talking too much, I think.
Well, let's take a few more questions from the audience. Now on this side, the lady towards the grey wall, about halfway up.
I haven't forgotten the other question. I'll come back to it. I just realised.
If you keep your hands up as I'm pointing to you, the ladies will find you with the mics. That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Eva, and I work here as a teacher. I'm also studying international development and education, and I'm particularly interested in the sustainable development goals and sustainable development through education. But you mentioned that the sustainable development goals are an opportunity for us to address children's rights, and I agree in the long-term perspective, but do you think that government's assistance and focus on the sustainable development goals in order to live up to these objectives might be hindering humanitarian assistance and therefore your objective here? I mean, does it actually have a difference? Does it give you limitations in terms of the budgets that you receive from the governments? Or is there a lot of freedom for you to decide how you spend the money, and can you divert that towards more humanitarian assistance? So is it a good fact that there are sustainable development goals in terms of humanitarian assistance, or is it actually hindering it a bit?
Yes, lady in the front, down here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Laura, and I work with Peace Direct. And my question is around what you spoke on about hope, your hopes for the future. And I think perhaps one of the things that there's a tendency to, perhaps in the general peace-building development debate and talk, is to forget about many of the local organizations, local people on the ground in these countries, mm-hmm. who have great potential, who have great local knowledge, contextual knowledge, and who are in these places and know where these children are. Yeah. And I think there is definitely, despite it being mentioned in the development goals and in doing development differently and Paris, all of that, there's still a huge gap in the amount of support that reaches these organizations, a tendency to, for big organizations to come in, perhaps have some local partners, but still leading very much on this work. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that, because I think that them being there is a huge source of hope if they get the support needed.
Yes. Gentleman in the middle, please. Whoever is nearest with the mic.
Hi, my name is James. I'm a student at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, but I'm also researching with War Child Holland. Two related questions on research. Compared to clusters in health or WASH, to what extent do you think we really know what works and doesn't in terms of sound, valid evidence base for child protection interventions? And I'm thinking of child-friendly spaces, which is often universally used almost, and community protection groups, especially in armed conflict. And my second question is, what other areas of research we are then lacking in, and how do you suggest we can research child protection ethically in the future?
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for those questions. I haven't forgotten the woman question. I'll come back to that. And, well, first of all, Is it the case that the Sustainable Development Goals is actually not productive for the humanitarian goals? I don't think that is the case. I think, as I was also given an example of in my first remarks, it is very important that we both have the rights-based agenda combined with development, because that is when it really starts moving. It is actually extraordinary that Afghanistan, which really is a very poor country, I've been there a few times myself, that they have actually had that development in children's survival and health over the last 15 years. Why is that? That is because there has been a lot of development money pouring into Afghanistan. That's how it should be. And also because we have actually had an agenda there where children were protected in a different way. So I think that combination is very powerful. And what we're actually seeing now, some of you may shout if this is not correct, is that the humanitarian funding is going a little bit better than development funding, because development funding is the long way to change things. Development funding is where you actually go in and you change governments and you change this and you change that. Humanitarians maybe sound a little bit better to a home audience. So that is where the difficulty is right now. So I believe that the combination of each country, member states of the UN right now, have an obligation towards the Sustainable Development Goals. It's all of us. It's all countries. Not just some, but all of us. So there's a universality there that is very important. And then on top of that, we have the humanitarian the humanitarian rights that we are talking about here. That is a very powerful combination. So please we shouldn't let those two goals compete. And of course, if you can't solve humanitarian crisis, when I'm telling you that we have 30 million children that are, for one reason or the other, displaced in the world, it's a very high number. Many of them will be in humanitarian settings as well. And if we don't get to them, we will not live up to the Sustainable Development Goals, that's for sure. So those things are very, very connected. That's how I see it. Also, someone was asking about the research in this area. I think you're right. I'm not sure we have all the right research we need in this area. What is it actually that goes wrong? We have some progress. We just had a safe schools declaration, and that is because, I mean, schools should be safe, and we have now agreed how schools should be safe and how they should be defined. But maybe we need, as I was also saying, we need much more monitoring, we need much more evidence, and maybe that is also, we also need much more research in what actually works in this area. The children's safe spaces, I mean, we run a lot of, in small settings, we have safe spaces, it's a signature program of Save the Children, that we do safe spaces for children. It's a wonderful thing, and that is part of it, but I'm sure you're right, we could need more research. And that's the last thing I want to say to someone who was asking, what is the hope here? Is there any hope? Can we move the needle on this one? And I just want to say to you that I think there's still a reason to have hope in this area. When I started working with area children in war and conflicts, I was just like, oh God, people are so awful, nothing can be done, what is the progress here? But then we're seeing change in Colombia, for example. That is very powerful, what's happened there. Right as we speak, they are negotiating in Geneva about Cyprus, about a peace agreement in Cyprus. That is a very powerful thing that we are seeing there. So we need to remember that there are good things happening in terms of creating a better foundation for children in the future. You were asking something more. What was something I didn't answer? Yes, that was very important. I can't read my own writing, so that's why. That was very important. I so strongly believe that. And that is connected to the Sustainable Development Goals as well. I think the powerful part of that is that we have goals, we have agreed them, there's 17, we understand them, but that they should be owned by each individual government. And that also means that they should be owned by local, regional NGOs. And that is very powerful, and we will very often, and it's part of the way we see the world changing, that we will go in and work with local partners instead of trying to, in the old style, do everything ourselves. That is not the way we think about change. We see change and lasting change as working with local partners so that everything doesn't fall away when you leave. And I think the future for Save the Children and other international NGOs is only through local partners. We are aiming to, in 10, 20 years, to be an organization that have, we are a member-based organization. It's been very northern, very western, what we have, but we are developing organizations now in completely different places. We are developing, we have a Save the Children India. We have just decided to change our Save the Children in Jordan into a member organization, becoming a local not a partner anymore, but a member organization. We will do the same in Indonesia, the Philippines, and other countries. And I think that is where our future is, not to go in and work and then leave, not only to go in to work with local partners, but actually have members that are from those countries. That's quite powerful, I think, and we're going there. What? No, but I'll take that. That was my last answer.
Right. Yeah. I will say that.
Got
then.
It under control. Yeah.
A few more questions from the audience.
I'll put it in a box of other questions. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Right at the far back at the top, please.
Could you just tell me when this last round?
And I think. Yeah, I'm probably getting closer. I think I'll take five.
Yeah, take five.
Hello, my name is Mille, and I'm from Helle's home country, Denmark. I have a question about what we, I know you mentioned a little bit about what individuals can do, but I find it very difficult sitting here as a person by myself. I really want to support. I think a lot of people feel the same way. They want to do something, but they're not sure what to do. You mentioned try to change the, or put attention towards the politics, but it's, again, a difficult thing to do as a single person or as an individual. So it would be good to hear some ideas and some thoughts on that. Yeah. Thank you.
Right. I'm just conscious of the time. I think what we'll do is I'll take another three questions, and then we'll come back to Helle for her concluding remarks. So this will be the final three. Oh, a very quick hand went up over there. I think winning the speed race. There we go.
Hi, my name is Juana, and I'm a student at UCL. I'm studying economics. Thank you very much for your speech. My question is very brief. In my opinion, protecting children means protecting their families. Could you please give us some brief examples of initiatives of Save the Children in this sense? Thank you.
Right in the middle, please. That's it. Exactly in the middle, I think, of the room. There we go. Yes.
Hello, thank you for your talk. It was very inspiring. I'm actually 16 years old, so I guess I am a child. And yeah, I'm a Year 12 student, and I'm actually campaigning to be a member of the UK Youth Parliament. And because your organisation puts a lot of emphasis on children in obviously unfortunate situations, I was wondering what your perspectives might be on how we as children, because you believe that children are the future,
yeah.
So how not only children in these situations, obviously to get the fundamental vital necessities for life, but also those who are more fortunate in developed countries, what we can also do, and perhaps if there's a need for action in order to inspire us to take these positions in organisations. Thank you.
Yeah. Right. Final question over here. Gentlemen on the edge, please.
Hi, my name is Shafiq, and I'm a law student from BPP. Simply, my question is, why is it that the international community is so reluctant to pressure the US government to curb arms sales to Riyadh and Saudi Arabia, especially cluster bombing bombs? Thank you.
Yep. That's it. I mean, the last question, I think, is there are very, very strong interest around that particular country. I think everyone knows that. It's been a debate in the UK as well about who do you sell weapons to. And I've been, I mean, I haven't been to Yemen, and I want to go to Yemen if it's possible to go there. But I think it is very clear that there are things that are happening in Yemen where schools are being targeted, perhaps hospitals as well. And there is, it should have been clearer to the governments that were involved there, including the Saudi Arabian government, that they should have been told by the international community. And even that, which is quite a small thing considering, that was very difficult. They ended on the shaming list, and they were not happy with that, as I said before, and I believe that that was a mistake, that they first got off and then they got on. That was that. There should have been clearer language towards that country. But we all know the political implications of that. Mona is asking, what about protecting families? You're absolutely right. Children are and should be with their families. So very, very often the path to helping children, in our case, is to help families. And a lot of it is, of course, helping mothers. Helping mothers having the knowledge that their children have to be vaccinated. Helping mothers having a health clinic they can go to. And that is very, very much part of our what we do. When I go out and meet children, I often meet their families as well, their mothers, be it their fathers who are fighting against child marriage, be it their mothers who have dragged five children to a camp we're running in Ethiopia when they were on the verge of hunger in Ethiopia earlier in 16 to provide the nutrition for those children and also a setting which is almost a school. That is helping the families, the mothers, and of course the children. So that is almost always part of our remit, and it's very much what we do. But what I like about Save the Children, and that is always seen from the perspective of the child. You always have to imagine this 1 meter tall or 120 tall person that is asking of you, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I think that is quite powerful, but of course that means helping families as well. You were also asking, what can children do? And I believe that is very powerful. I would really like children and young people to speak up much more. After the Brexit vote, I don't think I'm saying too much when I say that I was hoping for a Remain, personally. And certainly my children, who are 17 and 20, were very much hoping for a Remain. And they were furious after that vote. They phoned me 24th of June that morning and said, what is happening? Why are people not listening to young people? And I think people should listen to young people. But the only way to do that is if children and young people actually get together and demand to have a voice. So I was turning to her and my daughters and to their friends and saying, if you want things to change, you need to speak up. Children can't already do that, and we are facilitating, we're actually helping children to speak up. I was in Sierra Leone and met a very powerful group of children. They were like 12 years old, girls that are fighting against child marriage and for children's rights in general, and we are helping them to do that. That's another example of working with local partners. This is just a child organization. We are supporting them and helping them. So I believe that is a very, very powerful thing and should happen more. And the last thing I want to say, that was to you up there, Mille. I can really understand that everyone sits as an individual and asks themselves, what can I do? But I think particularly in a group of students, where many of you have already shared what area expertise you are interested in, what research area you want to follow, there's so much to do. There's so much to do. Let's find out how many children are actually being trafficked in Europe. I don't have that figure right now. Is that a research question? Let's find out how much we have seen the increase in children getting married very, very young in Europe as a result of the refugee crisis. Let's find out about how many children are been given up to slavery because of war being waged against children. All these questions are very important, and we have some answers, but I can assure you we don't have all the answers. So I invite all of you who have your daily life here in a research institution to help us. Help us get the figures out there. Help us get the research. Help us get the attention to these issues. I think that's a very useful thing to be doing, just to give you an example. I need to wrap up, and I want to wrap up by saying, first of all, to the question about is it hard to be a woman leader? Yes, it is. There's other questions that you get asked as a woman leader. I still, after many years, and after I just told you my children are quite big, I still get asked about, so how much did you let your children down when they were small and you were the leader of a party and being prime minister? I still get asked about that, as I think many women leaders do. I think the last year have shown us that women leaders get judged differently than men do. And I often imagine if Hillary Clinton had been caught talking about groping men and the stuff you can do to women and stuff like that, I think that would have been quite disqualifying for her. And also, for many years, we've been told that women are not qualified enough to certain posts. Now, suddenly, the goalposts are actually changing, and you can be overqualified to things. So I think there is a double standard here that we still need to address, and I'm sure many of you are doing that in your research work. But I also feel encouraged by tonight. I think that many of you who have asked questions, at least two-thirds, perhaps even more, have been women, wanting to engage and participate in the debate, and I just really encourage that. I believe in a world where men and women are equal, where everyone has the right to speak up, where children have the right to speak up, and where everyone has the right to be heard. And I believe that the example you have given tonight, where women are speaking up and demanding answers to their question, it is great to see. So to all women here, just keep doing it. You can follow your passions, you can change things, you can have children at the same time, you can have a family, and you can actually, your whole life, be trying to serve and change the world if that is what you wish. And a lot of the discussion we have had tonight is actually about that. That it is possible, even though things seem very, very difficult, it is possible to try to reach out there and try to make this world a better place for all of us, and particularly for children. Thank you very much.